Well, I guess I'm going to be the glasses half empty guy. Not generally my disposition. I'm generally an optimist. But when it comes to this subject, I can be a little pessimistic. And I'll use my 20 minutes to explain why. First of all, I just want to thank RJ and Ed and Chris for inviting me and involving me in this discussion. It's a topic I care about deeply. So I want to begin by explaining that the problem that many people have with originalism, and I would include myself in this category, is not necessarily originalism as a theory, it's originalism as a practice. So there are certainly people who are critical of the entire apparatus of originalism as a mode of interpretation. I'm not in that group, and I'll do my best to represent people who are in that group and do a faithful job. But let me just state at the outset what my criticism is. I've been writing about originalism and legal conservatism for several years now. And my focus is not that originalism is wrong or common good constitutionalism is right or anything like that. It's that originalism as a practice is essentially suffused with the civil rights regime. The morality that comes out of the civil rights order has essentially overwhelmed originalism. By the morality of the civil rights order, I'm referring to two values that have really taken over American constitutionalism. One is the value that diversity is our greatest good, and therefore everything and anything must be done to advance that, hence the persistence of affirmative action over the past 75 years. And the second is that discrimination is our greatest evil, hence all of the exceptions to our constitutional order that come from that. I don't see originalism flourishing because originalism must constantly capitulate and accommodate these values. And you could see this in many decisions. The Warren Court that Ed was just referring to mounted a revolution through the Constitution. Those decisions have not been overruled, and they will not be overruled. What I mean by the decisions that changed our regime, I'm referring to the expansion of the nature of the Commerce Clause, the nature of the Spending Clause, the incorporation of all of the Bill of Rights, the expansion of judicial power. All of these things have mounted a revolution, and I don't think a single one of them is on the agenda for originalists at this point. So I don't see how originalism could work until it confronts that task. All right, so that's my focus. Let's talk a little bit about common good constitutionalism and originalism. This is a debate that really came into the public discussion just a few years ago. It's a result of Adrian Vermeule, a Harvard Law School professor, writing an article that criticized the originalist project. And what he said essentially in that article is that originalism has succeeded the way that Ed just described, and now we need to move beyond it. We need to create something else. And in that article, he said that new thing is what he described as common good constitutionalism, and he then wrote a book on that subject. And the person that he was most directly opposing was Randy Barnett, a law school professor at Georgetown Law School and one of the leading originalists in the country and also a libertarian-oriented thinker. So Vermeule is attacking not just originalism as such, but a certain variety of originalism, what might be called libertarian originalism. This debate, in my view, is not entirely new. So if you look at the founding, there are certainly thinkers who look like they're doing something like common good constitutionalism. So if you read Hamilton's Defense of the Bank, the memo in 1790, in which he explains why the Necessary and Proper Clause should be interpreted to authorize the creation of a national bank, he's doing common good constitutionalism of a variety, at least. And that, of course, becomes the basis for Chief Justice Marshall's upholding the bank in McCulloch v. Maryland. That also has some of the traces of common good constitutionalism. You could argue that James Wilson's constitutionalism has a common good constitutionalist orientation. And on the other side, you could point to people like Madison, Jefferson, Spencer Roane of the Virginia Supreme Court as doing something that looks a lot more like originalism. So I don't think we have one tradition. I don't even know if I would say we have two traditions. But these are traditions that are firmly rooted in our republic. So I wouldn't say that we're just committed to originalism or to common good constitutionalism, although Vermeule and Barnett essentially do say that. My focus is not to defend either one of these. My focus is more rooted in the fact that, you know, I'm not a law professor, I'm not a judge, so I don't need to say I'm an originalist or not. What I am is a Christian, I'm a conservative, and I'm a constitutional theorist. So I'm interested in how to make this system work, how to make this order work, in a way that preserves the American way of life. And by that I mean the preservation of the faith, the families, and the communities of this country. And the way that originalism is working right now is not doing that. Now, Ed correctly points out that originalism is merely a mode of interpretation, and it is not fair to accuse originalism of contributing to the demise of American family life, right? So 40% of American children are born outside of marriage. That's not the fault of originalism. But it is our fault. It's the fault of conservatives, and it's the fault of legal conservatives. What I mean by that is that legal conservatives have made the mistake of spending all of their political and intellectual capital on originalism. So legal conservatism is not originalism. Ed is right about that. But it acts that way. We treat legal conservatism as though it is merely originalism and there's nothing else to it. The Federalist Society was formed in 1982 not as an originalist society. It was formed as a debating society. What it has become, however, is an originalist society. That's fine if that's what the Federalist Society is going to be, but legal conservatism can then not just be the Federalist Society. It will not work as a movement. That is not how the legal left has essentially won, right? All the culture wars, all the legal wars, all the political wars have been won by the legal left. And that is because they have three things that legal conservatives do not have and do not seem interested in having. They have a concrete and enduring agenda. You know exactly what the legal left is trying to do. They spell it out for you and they think about it concretely. It's not a mode of interpretation. They're not trying to get a certain interpretation or methodology out there. They're trying to get something accomplished. And they're thinking about that and organizing to do it. Secondly, they have a moral narrative supporting what they're doing, right? So they explain what they want. If it's sexual autonomy, if it's affirmative action, they give a moral narrative to substantiate that. And three, they link that moral narrative to an actual political movement. Legal conservatives don't do any of these things. Instead of an agenda, we have a mode of interpretation. Instead of trying to come up with a moral explanation to substantiate what we're doing, we say it's just a mode of interpretation. We don't need to engage in the moral sphere. And third, we don't engage with the political constituency. And the political constituency that would support it is a struggling constituency. And I think Rusty explained why it's struggling quite adeptly. So does that mean that we should support something like Vermeule's approach? Well, I don't think so personally, but I don't say that just as a principle outright. I don't think it's just a bad method of interpretation. I just don't think it fits this country and this constitutional order, because I think four things are essentially required for that approach to work. One, you need a certain scale. I think you need a smaller country. If I were in Israel or Poland, I might support common good constitutionalism, but not for a country of 330 million people. Second, I think you need a homogeneous population. Not entirely homogeneous, but there needs to be something that's going to bind people together to create a common good. It's not going to come from above. It's going to have to come from the roots, from the people. Three, you need a common faith and moral norms to bind those people. We don't have that here. And fourth, related to that, I think you need a constitutional morality, something that will bind the political rulers to the governed. Without those features, I don't see how common good constitutionalism could work, and I therefore do not favor any sort of experimentation with it within the United States. But that isn't to say that it has no applicability to a country with a different character, a different history, and a different tradition. So how then, if we're not going to support something like common good constitutionalism, I think Ed and I would agree pretty strongly on that, how do we make originalism work? Well, I think that we need to stop thinking of it merely as a mode of interpretation and start thinking about how to supplement it, right? How do we make it flourish? How do we sustain it? And what that means is thinking in terms of an agenda that will correct the problems that I've identified, right? The problems of diversity being our greatest strength, discrimination being our greatest evil. And just to wrap up and kind of connect it to some of the Establishment Clause church-state relations issues that Ed was referring to, I don't take Kennedy, the decision dealing with the football coach, to be a triumph. I mean, it's a victory to be sure. But the problem is still there in that it's not an originalist decision. The original meaning of the Establishment Clause was to say that Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion, which means Congress may neither establish nor disestablish, meaning that the federal government has no jurisdictional authority over church-state relations, which means that states get to have religious establishments, which means that it makes no sense to incorporate the Establishment Clause to apply to the states. So as dubious as incorporation of other constitutional provisions may be, it is entirely incoherent as applied to the Establishment Clause. Nevertheless, we don't hear our leading originalists making that argument. And it's only if that argument is made that, as Rusty alluded to, Fargo could be Fargo and New York could be New York, right? You're not going to have school prayer in New York City. The population will not permit it. But maybe it could work elsewhere. But our system will not permit that, because our system is devoted to the civil rights idea that what applies in one region must apply everywhere. That's the problem, right? So I see originalism as actually not solving the problem, because it's not dealing with that issue that for a religiously diverse population, you may need to have different constitutional rules or permit the sort of flexibility that would allow those religious communities to flourish. So that's what I mean by a new agenda. It's one that still works within the confines of originalism, but picks out the pieces that would be essential for this project to work. And we could go through various constitutional provisions that I think have been neglected, various decisions that I think have been mistaken, but that's what I think we should be focusing on, not the theoretical questions of whether common good constitutionalism is a more proper mode of interpretation. I think we need to focus within originalism on how to make that project work. All right, thank you very much.